You're listening to a 95BFM podcast.
You're tuned into The Wire. 1 hour of current affairs and analysis starting now.
Tēnā koutou katoa, ko Bronwyn Wild tōku ingoa. Nau mai, haere mai ki Te Wire mō tēnei rā. Kia ora and welcome to The Wire for Wednesday the 10th of June. My name is Bronwyn and I'll be with you for the next hour. This is my first Wire covering for the great Lillian Hanley, which are some big boots to fill, but luckily helping me to do it, I have producer Felix and Jemima, our new news director. How's it going? We've had an interesting start to the morning.
It's been flawlessly executed as always.
Hope it's all uphill from here. All right, e whaiake nei coming up on the show. I spoke to Eugenie Sage about the reopening of the Great Walks following the lifting of the COVID-19 rāhui and have some conservation chats in general. Felix brings us a report on libraries and the role they play in the community. We have Dear Science with Marcus Jones today, talking about tracing the origin of COVID-19, some mysterious extraterrestrial radio frequencies, and the British switch from burning coal. Jemina speaks to New Zealand On Air about government funding for arts and music and where it will go. And lastly, I'll bring a report on the armed response team's trials, which have been disbanded. Ka oe ware ware e ahe ana koutou te whakarongo ki e nei kōrero anō hei pakihere rokiroki, marunga I te pai tukutuku o irirangi poho. Me haere ki 95BFM irakati.com. You can catch all these stories and more by podcast on the 95BFM website. And if you want to share your thoughts with us, tuku pātuhi mai, you can text us on 5395. Waia mai rānei, or give us a call in studio on 309 3879.
Can anyone explain why the modern day whales are so big?
The Wire.
Well, on the 23rd of March, the Department of Conservation hut and campsite bookings were ceased when New Zealand was back at alert level 2 and backcountry huts were closed under alert level 3. However, the department has now announced that bookings for the Great Walks will reopen between yesterday and tomorrow, with the exception of the Milford and Rootburn tracks, which are still undergoing storm repairs. You can expect to book those two later in July or August. Other than those two Great Walks, booking for all other dock huts and campsites will reopen on the 25th of June. I spoke to Eugenie Sage about this.
They're open for bookings, and it's a great opportunity for New Zealanders to get out into our backyards and experience some really spectacular landscapes. What DOC has found in the past is that when bookings open, because New Zealanders are competing with international visitors, the hut bookings fill up very, very quickly. The department has said that international residents shouldn't book at the moment when our borders are closed. So it's a chance for New Zealanders to book for areas like Milford Track when that opens in July, or book for the walks that are open for business like the Paparoa 29, Lake Waikare Moana, Abel Tasman and Rakiura and the Hifi.
And so you mentioned, yeah, two of those great walks, the Milford and the Rootburn, are currently undergoing storm repairs, so they won't be open until a little bit later in the year.
There was major storm damage from a big storm in March. With a changing climate, we're getting more intense weather events. That caused significant damage on the Rootburn and the Milford tracks. It really caused damage to the Howden Hut on the Rootburn and took out bridges and the like on a length of the Sandfly Point end of the track at Milford. The government in Budget 2020 provided $13 million for track and infrastructure repairs. That work is underway at the moment, so it's expected that the Rootburn and Milford tracks will be open later this year, so bookings for that will open in July, August.
And so I wonder, this might be a little bit off topic from what we're talking about directly today, but I wanted to know your thoughts on perhaps future-proofing these tracks and facilities, as we're inevitably going to be facing similar weather events such as floods with increasing frequency due to the effects of climate change.
Changing climate is meaning more intense weather events, and so I've asked the department to ensure that the work that's being done on the Rootburn and Milford and other tracks takes that into account and aims to make the visitor facilities and infrastructure more resilient. issues like on the Abel Tasman, for example, the department has had to move emergency campgrounds further back from the coast because in some events the reach of the waves and just the wind in the waves was affecting existing campgrounds. So a changing climate is having an impact on visitor facilities, huts and tracks and campgrounds on the conservation estate, and the Department of Conservation is looking at how to make those facilities more resilient.
And so I noted that the other huts and campsites owned by DOC will be opening later this month after the Great Walks on the 25th, and I understand that you're using a new online booking service. And I was wondering, is that going to replace the old system entirely where you'd go to an information centre or DOC office to buy your hut passes?
The Department of Conservation has invested a lot in upgrading the booking system for these huts, tracks, campgrounds, which are owned by all New Zealanders and operated by the Department on behalf of the New Zealand public. And the online system with the online information on the DOC website provides a really good guide to the tracks, what people can expect to see, the conditions that they can expect. So it won't replace people calling in at visitor centres, but it is more efficient and people can get a lot more information online. But would encourage people before they go out on any of these tracks to let someone know before they go to check the weather and the track conditions and to make sure they take the necessary food, water, clothing and equipment. And calling into visitor centres, information centres is often a really good way to talk to DOC staff and get the latest info on the tracks and the conditions.
And now health has obviously been a big topic lately, and increasingly mental health as people are still adjusting to having been inside for a number of weeks. And I wanted to know your thoughts on the health benefits of getting out in nature in our national parks.
What the alert levels showed, and more New Zealanders walking locally, and more people reporting birds, and I don't think it was that there are increased birds in our cities and towns, it's just people were taking the time to notice them. And getting out in nature is always a way for me of just restoring a sense of balance and well-being. And I think the exercise, being out in the weather, the sunshine, or even if it's raining, and just connecting with nature is a really good basis for well-being.
I think it's interesting how you noted, yeah, about people seeing more birds, because I also heard articles throughout lockdown about people talking about an increase in pests, because obviously a lot of the pest control projects were being disturbed by that. And I was wondering how the department was planning to get on track and what role the $148 million funding from the government will play in that.
There has been a huge commitment in Budget 2020 to nature-based jobs, $1.1 billion investment in extra funding over 4 years. And a big chunk of that, over $140 million, is for pest and predator control. A chunk of that will be going to predator-free New Zealand with really ambitious plans to be predator-free by 2050. That goes into landscape-scale projects, working with landholders, community organisations, iwi and hapu, to eradicate possums, rats and stoats in areas that can be defended from re-invasion. And a chunk of it too will go to community organisations to assist in some of the more localised predator-free trapping projects that we've got around cities and towns across the motu.
Now, I have a quote here from Nationals conservation spokesperson Jackie Dean, saying that DOC has been showing a lack of compassion towards tourism businesses which hold concessions to operate on conservation land throughout the lockdown. I was wondering if you would be able to comment on that.
The lockdown and the closure of the borders has really had a huge impact on tourism businesses. So the government's responded with the wage subsidy. All the concessionaires operating on conservation land, they can apply for that if they're eligible. And government recently announced a $400 million package of assistance for the tourism industry, protecting our strategic tourism assets. The Prime Minister recently, or today, announced some of that will be used to help Kaikoura Whale Watch, recognising the central importance of whale watch to tourism in Kaikoura. And there is also the work the department has been doing working with operators one-on-one to understand their circumstances. There was a waiver of or a delay. People were given an extra month to pay invoices. A lot of the concession fees are activity-based. They're on a per-person basis. So if the visitors aren't being guided, for example, then the operators won't be paying that activity fee to DOC. So utterly reject National's comment about a lack of compassion. This government recognises the pressure on the tourism sector, and with the $400 million package, the wage subsidy for businesses has responded to that.
And kind of talking about tourism and also international visitors, I would like to lastly turn to the differential pricing, which I understand there was a trial going on the past 2 years, and I was wanting to know what the outcomes of that trial is, as well as what is differential pricing?
Differential pricing was where international visitors were paying twice what New Zealanders paid to stay in a hut on a Great Walk, and the department undertook the trial for two summer seasons. The results of that showed that there was a bit of feeling that the twice the rate was a bit much. So it's planned to have a rate that's 1.5 times for international visitors what New Zealanders pay for a night in a hut on a Great Walk. So there's no charge to walk the track, but people do pay to stay in a hut. And this recognises that international visitors can contribute more to the costs of maintaining those Great Walks.
And so will you be going ahead with that 1.5 differential pricing this year?
No, I think that's not on the books for this year, but it will be reinstated after that.
That was me, Bronwyn, talking to Eugenie Sage about the reopening of the DOC Great Walks. Booking for Abel Tasman, Hefi Kepler, Lake Waikaremoana, Paparoa, Rakiura, Tongariro and the Whanganui River journey should all be open by tomorrow. And some of those are already open, so you can go and check it out and book online. Other huts and campsites will be the 25th of this month, but note you'll need to make one of those online user accounts, which you can only do by the 23rd of June. We'll be right back after a break.
Is there a nice dinner place in town?
Well, you know Jenny from Spanish class?
Yeah.
She was sitting next to me every day until eventually I got up the courage and asked her out to Mezi Bar.
So, Mezi Bar?
It never really worked out. We wanted different things. I guess that's the beauty of tapas.
Mezi Bar. Great food, great drinks, great memories. Your Mediterranean oasis right in the centre of town, Durham Street East. For hours and info, go to mezibar.co.nz.
Being in the dark about your KiwiSaver is no big deal, right? It's just money. A few dollars. A few $100,000. Who needs to retire? On the other hand, you could talk to Kōra Wealth. Their 100% Kiwi-owned and operated KiwiSaver scheme is personalised for you, so you get the retirement you deserve. Ethical investments and some of the lowest fees in the industry. Shine a light on your future with Kōra Wealth. Visit kourawealth.co.nz today. That's K-O-U-R-A wealth.co.nz.
Icons, visionaries, thought leaders. Half Queen and Zeki bring you H2Ho Radio. The sounds of the underground from floaty hip-hop to wild international club heat. Just two queers making it through the night and bringing you their freshest finds and most beautiful mixes. Do we turn a misty morning breeze? H2Ho Radio. Saturday nights 11 to 1 a.m. only on 95 BFM. Stay hydrated, stay wet.
I don't know, and frankly, the whole thing gives me the heebie-jeebies.
The Wire. We're all geared up and ready to get back out into the community now that we're in level one, so it seems pertinent to talk about one part of our communities that often gets uncelebrated, and that is the library. Last month's budget announcement had a lot going on. The $50 billion recovery budget has been touted as the biggest in New Zealand's history, so you'd be forgiven for not taking it all in. One of the lesser recognised aspects of this budget was a $60 million funding boost for our libraries. Internal Affairs Minister Tracy Martin said the boost would allow librarians to play a greater role in their communities, particularly as people begin seeking jobs following the fallout from COVID-19. That funding boost acknowledges a vital secondary function that libraries serve, well beyond loaning books, and just how many hats librarians wear. To look at just how important library workers have been in recent months, we definitely have to talk about the lockdown. Back in April, the Auckland Council made the decision to redeploy some of their staff to assist the city's more vulnerable residents during the lockdown. That involved more than 50 library staff members making as many as 15,000 welfare calls to elderly people living alone. Even outside of lockdown conditions, library workers are constantly providing support for older people, whether that's emotional support, such as the previous example, or technical. Here is the reading engagement specialist for Auckland Library, Alison Fitzpatrick, talking to RNZ about just that.
And even if you just need to ask us, look, how do I get on the Wi-Fi? Can you help me with that? You know, there's no question that's too small for us.
Oh, that's wonderful to hear.
Yeah. And the other sort of stuff we have, apart from our physical collection of books, we've got great e-books and e-audio. There's a lot of motivational and career-type material on those. We've got access to Press Reader, which is the collection of world's newspapers.
And that can Press really, Reader, yes.
Yeah, Press Reader, yeah. And then we've got e-magazines. We've got academic journals.
And books as well.
And books, yeah.
At the end of that clip, Alison spoke about some of the various forms of media that the library deals in, and this gives me a lovely segue into the topic of accessibility. Audiobooks and e-magazines are a couple of the examples she gave, and for a lot of people, these forms of reading are very important. For elderly people with poor eyesight, it's especially difficult to read a conventional book. Being able to adjust text size on an e-reader, or even better, pop in some headphones and have somebody else do the work for you, can be a complete game changer. Just ask my granddad, who is at least partially responsible for my looking into this topic. Another factor in accessibility is the notion of digital exclusion. Digital exclusion, if you haven't heard of it, is essentially the idea that as more government agencies move to digital means of interaction, being websites or even just email, becomes harder for certain people to actually participate within society in the same way that they used to. This isn't some sort of old people problem either. Earlier this year, the Citizens Advice Bureau published a report on digital exclusion and actually found that it affected everybody relatively equally, with ages 30 to 80 being pretty much consistent. For some people, this is an accessibility issue, those without internet or with limited access to computers. But for others, it's a matter of confidence. At the end of the day, not everybody wants to use a computer, and some people just don't feel comfortable doing it. To be fair, computers do give a fair bit more room for error than a printed document in a face-to-face chat. That same report also found that Māori and Pacifica peoples were disproportionately affected by digital exclusion, making 37% of cases, while only being about 25% of the national population. Part of the budget's funding boost for libraries is an effort to mitigate this issue, ensuring that every library in the country has free internet access, while librarians can tackle issues of confidence with digital media. One crucial area where we can see this happening right now is in job seeking. With unemployment at an unfortunate high point, librarians have found themselves taking on the role of supporting the job seeking process. This isn't exactly a new role, though, but it is one that has found a new level of importance with the way things are right now, as Alison Fitzpatrick told RNZ.
We've always done this sort of thing for people. We've always had a lot of great resources. But when we realised that things were getting really tough and seeing, you know, what challenging times we're living in, we realised it was a good chance to highlight the resources and the collection and services that we have.
Those services include things like access to online courses about writing CVs and applying for jobs, or librarians pointing people in the right direction to get more serious support. In this sense, libraries are very much doing what they've always done, giving people access to information, but now more than ever, that information is increasingly community and people-oriented. Libraries continue to evolve the ways in which they function as a public service, and the recent investment by the government appears to be acknowledging that effort. Libraries almost feel as though they're being redefined. Even when, for some, books fall out of fashion, the need for accessible information certainly won't, and it looks as though libraries won't either. Thank you to RNZ and Alison Fitzpatrick for that interview that I very gratefully ripped off, and I'll hand the reins back to Bronnie.
Oh, wow. It's time for Dear Science, thanks to MOTAT, Auckland's Museum of Transport and Technology.
Yes, it is Dear Science, but not with Lillian today, but with me, Bronnie. And today I spoke to Marcus Jones. We talked about a couple of topics, the first being tracing the origin of COVID-19. Secondly, some mysterious extraterrestrial radio frequencies that are being picked up. And Britain switching from burning coal. We'll see if we have time for all those topics, but enjoy.
The first story is another one about coronavirus. We've been doing that every time I've been on for the last few months now. And the question this week is, it's sort of a big mystery, is what will it take to get to the source of the coronavirus? You know, where did it come from? And how do we find that out? And there's a couple of, favorites, or I think there's a clear favorite, and then there's the conspiracy theory, which is actually going to be a bit difficult to disprove. The clear favorite is that it originated in bats, almost certainly originated in bats. And there's been a lot of analysis of the coronavirus in China, which is really adding weight to that theory. But there is a lack of clarity about how the virus passed to people, and that has led to unsubstantiated theories promoted especially by Mr. Trump that it escaped from a lab in China, and in particular a lab in Wuhan, China, which has actually got samples of different types of coronavirus, and it's one of the main centers in China for studying those sort of viruses. But most researchers say that the most likely explanation, given what is known so far about the virus, is that bats passed it to an intermediate animal, which has been thought to maybe be a pangolin. It could be something else. I don't know. But then that spread, that intermediate animal spread it to humans. The difficulty is that the nature of the evidence means it's going to be hard to track down the source, the animal source. And that also means it's difficult to completely rule out this facility, the Wuhan Institute of Virology, in question as the source. This Virology Center, Virology Institute, is very highly regarded for its work on bat coronaviruses. It is located in the city where the outbreak first emerged, but really that's probably just a coincidence. The speculation is unsubstantiated. And there's lots of evidence, or there's a growing amount of evidence, that the virus passed over naturally, and some of which we've actually talked about on this show a couple of months ago, I think. And a lot of it is to do with the analysis of the DNA for the virus, and a lot of coronaviruses found in bats are very similar or closely related to the SARS-CoV-2 virus. It's very closely related to a group of viruses found in horseshoe bats, which is a particular bat species found in the area. And they found that it shares, a common corona-type virus called RATG13, which is found in horseshoe bats in Yunnan province, shares about 96% of its genetic sequence with the SARS-CoV-21 virus. The SARS-CoV-2 virus. There is also a possibility that the samples were only collected in China. There's also a possibility that the ancestor may have come from neighboring Myanmar or Laos, where horseshoe bats also live. So there's still speculation that the virus came from this lab, but really, unless a deep and sort of independent forensic analysis is done, it is very likely to be, near impossible to disprove that. But most researchers think it is very, very likely not to have come from the lab and just come from a natural carrier.
Yeah, and I wanted to talk about just that for a second, the theory of
sure.
Donald Trump and the like, that this did originate in the lab. What you personally think of that theory, but I also saw near the end of the article, there are some good reasons to believe that that is less likely.
Yeah, so, I mean, the lab holds a lot of coronaviruses, and it actually studies coronaviruses that are related to the recent one. And you know, you could come up with some plausible explanation that a lab worker accidentally became infected and then passed it to someone outside the facility. You know, it's even in the right town where the outbreak is thought to have started. It's theoretically possible that scientists tweaked the virus's genome for research before it escaped, but again, there's no evidence that they did. And I think certainly there's no record of accidents at the Institute, but viruses, including SARS, have previously accidentally escaped from labs, including labs in China. But none of this has ever led to a significant outbreak. It's possible, but extremely extremely unlikely. Whereas we know that previous coronaviruses that cause these, you know, severe acute respiratory syndromes have passed to people from bats by way of different animals. So the bat seems to be the source, and there has to be sort of an intermediate before it gets to humans. So previous outbreaks have gone through civets, and there's a Middle East respiratory syndrome, MERS, that went through camels. So it went from bats to camels and then to humans. So we have seen this before. This is not a sort of a new idea that these things can come from bats. And I really think, you know, some people, Mr. Trump in particular, is very happy to peddle these stories, these sort of scare stories, but I think it's very, very unlikely.
And so to turn to the second article that you've got here, I was wondering if you could tell me a bit about what these fast radio bursts are and what makes them so mysterious.
Yeah, so about 15 years ago, astronomers started seeing these really fast, means that they don't take very long, they're milliseconds, maybe a few seconds at most, bursts of very high energy radio waves. Now, by the time they reach us, they're very, very weak because they've come such a long way, but you can trace them back to a source, usually an extragalactic source, or some source from another galaxy, not our own galaxy, and they're thought to be extremely powerful. They're a source of puzzlement, because we don't really know what's causing them, or we didn't really know what's causing them. There were some ideas. It's happened that in late April, a star in the Milky Way in our own galaxy suddenly blasted out a burst of radio energy. And it could, because this is so much closer, it could actually help us figure out what these things are, or what's the cause of these really big outbursts of energy, radio frequency energy, from stars. And it turns out, so I hadn't heard about these types of stars before. So the star that caused this burst in April is called a magnetar. And this is a type of star that is a very highly magnetic source. It is sort of the result of a supernova. So a star, reached the end of its life, exploded in this supernova, and left this very, very dense, very quickly fast-spinning sort of object in space that's wrapped in these really intense magnetic fields. So this star is known, and there are about 30 or so known stars of this type in our galaxy. And it turns out that this source, this observation that was done in April, came from this star. And so there were these theories that these fast radio bursts come from these magnetars, these magnetic stars. But this is a pretty good evidence that they actually do. So this star is only about 30,000 light years away, which is still a hell of a long way away. But you compare that to the radio bursts that have been observed previously, which are more like 500 million light years away, so an awful lot further away. And you can use this, I was reading the article, and this is really like a sort of a science fiction thing where you can imagine this weird object in space that's spinning really, really fast. And what they think is maybe it's got such powerful magnetic fields, they have these huge reservoirs of energy. And the one idea is that something is happening inside this magnetic star, like an earthquake or a starquake, that cracks the surface of the star and releases a whole bunch of energy. And this is this sudden outburst of radio waves that we can see. So it's like, you can imagine a sort of a science fiction sort of star thing that is pulsating and releasing this huge amounts of energy. And so that they because they've seen this now, they've seen this much, much closer up, they've got a much better idea of what's causing these things. The only thing is that the burst that was in April was about 1,000 times less powerful, less energetic than those seen in distant galaxies. So whereas, you know, this type may come from a magnetar, maybe those other ones, those much more powerful ones, come from something else. But it's still not conclusive, but it's, you know, it's a pretty good idea.
And something I thought was interesting about it is how it was detected for 90 days and then stopped for another 67 days and then repeated that pattern every 157 days. So it seems very cyclical. And what do you think contributes to that? What's going on there? Is it the orbit of something?
I have absolutely no idea. I mean, I think these are really sort of weird objects. We have no closer view of something that looks like this. So you're sort of using your imagination a little bit. But if you know, you can you know, picture something where really the star itself is almost being ripped apart by this huge magnetic field, and suddenly something gives, just like on Earth we have earthquakes where the crust sort of just gives a little and everything moves. You know, maybe those are causing the same sort of similar sort of effects on these stars, and maybe, I don't know why they would be cyclical. It seems, I have no idea.
Yeah, that's an interesting unsolved mystery there. I guess the other thought that's on everyone's minds, though, is it aliens? Which is what
I think almost certainly. I think almost certainly aliens.
Yeah. You think almost certainly? Because the article said almost certainly not.
Oh, if it's a possibility that aliens could be doing it, then yeah, I'd like to think it's aliens.
Well, then the next question.
Mind blown. That was Dear Science, thanks to MOTAT, Auckland's Museum of Transport and Technology.
The government's budget announcement last month included a $175 million recovery package for New Zealand's art and music industries. The support package is intended to boost the creative sector following the COVID-19 pandemic. The lockdown period devastated the arts and music industries, with bars, theatres and music venues unable to open throughout Level 4 and 3, and then with physical distancing rules and number restrictions in place in Level 2. Prime Minister Jacinda Ardern told RNZ that the arts sector recovery package would provide more opportunities for creatives to earn an income and keep their careers. I spoke to the head of music for New Zealand On Air, David Ridler, about the funding boost for New Zealand and why it is important that the government has given significant support to the music industry. I began by asking what New Zealand On Air Music's thoughts were when the government announced the recovery package.
Obviously, I guess a mixture of excitement and relief and appreciation. The fact that the arts are so revered and respected in this country, and that some resources, you know, a significant amount of resources being put into that area. I mean, as we all know, the effect on the arts and music in particular, and sort of my area of particular interest, has been pretty catastrophic over the last 2 or 3 months. So there's been a lot of hardship and some real pressure on the art, so it was really wonderful to see that announcement come through.
Why is it important to have support from the government at this time, particularly after the pandemic slowing everything down?
The support is, I mean, the arts in New Zealand generally need some kind of public support or public funding as it is, because we are such a small market. You know, 5 million people plus tourists when they're allowed in. It is not a huge market size to have everything in the arts fully commercially funded. So the arts has always been enjoyed a reasonable amount of public funding in this country, but the impact of the COVID restrictions, obviously the closing of borders, so less tourists and less activity in the arts in that sector, but most importantly that live music stopping as suddenly as it did in March had a massive impact, and I know that it impacted arts across the board in terms of no public performances. But I think, you know, as you realise, with musicians in particular, those with new releases to tour, or just a tour that they were doing regardless, or live music, or even recording in studio, which couldn't happen for a while as well. So it kind of put a massive handbrake on everything in the music world for that, especially that lockdown period.
I understand that New Zealand On Air has just announced where that funding will be going, or at least some of it. Could you please explain that?
Yeah, totally. So New Zealand On Air, 7.1 million of that overall arts recovery package is being allocated to New Zealand On Air music work that we do. And we have that over the next 2 years. So our financial year runs from July to June, so the next one kicks in from July this year. So over the next 2 years, we're going to be allocating that additional funding. And the great news is that's almost doubling NZ On Air's music budget over the next 2 years, which is amazing. So what we can announce, or what we have announced today, is a significant increase to our two sort of core music funding schemes. One is called New Music Project, and one is called New Music Single. And basically, over the last few years, we've been spending $1 million on each across the year through 5 funding rounds for each. Next year, we'll be doing 5 funding rounds for each. We'll be able to double that budget overall. So the changes that we've just announced is that for New Music Single, we are increasing individual grants from $8,000 to $10,000 per grant. So that grant can cover things like recording costs, video content creation, and sort of promotions costs as well. Incorporated in that $10,000 grant is a 10% or $1,000 artist creation fee. And that's the first time that we've actually allocated fees for the artists in NZ On Air funding history. So that comes into effect from the next funding round, which closes on the 25th of June. So that's the significant change there. And with the additional funding, that budget going from $1 million to $2 million means we'll be able to do not quite twice as many, because we are increasing the individual grants, but we'll be almost doubling the amount of singles that we'll be able to support with funding over the next year. And then the other change is to New Music Project, which is our more multi-single collection, sort of like EPs and album support, etc., or multi-single campaigns. The maximum grant for that was $30,000. That's been increased to $40,000, which again includes a 10% artist creation fee. And we've also, there's a co-investment principle with project funding, and you have to partner with a third-party New Zealand music company to assist with that project, but the co-investment reduces from 40% to 20%. So that's just been announced today, and that's sort of the first specific announcement that we're making about that additional funding, and we'll be making some more announcements over the coming weeks around the rest of the allocation.
Have you had any, I know it's been announced today, but have you had any response from creators and artists about the new allocation of the funding?
It hasn't been out long enough for me to see any responses yet, but I have talked to some industry representatives, and the reaction's been very favourable and positive. I mean, there is no secret that being a musician in New Zealand is not a cash cow. It's really hard work, and for most it's a labour of love. Again, small market. There's only so much touring revenue you can make. There's only, with the streaming ecology or an economy, there's not that much, unless you have a massive global hit in streaming services, it's pretty hard to make a lot of money out of the streaming, streaming side of things. So it's tricky. So, lots of support where we can. We can't support everybody, because we're still limited funds and we have almost unlimited demand, and we can't do everything. But for our part of the ecosystem, which is supporting content creation, We hope this will help. We think this will help.
This funding is allocated for this year. Do you think going forward, having had this money this time round, it'll be harder next time round, potentially not having as much support?
What we're doing is announcing just the next year of funding, because obviously we want to sort of keep monitoring the results, et cetera, before we finalise the funding for 21-22. But as I said at the start, that funding increase that we've got sits across 2 years. So we know we will have boosted funding for the next 2 years. What happens after that? I don't know. Look, obviously my ideal would be that everything is so amazingly successful that we can put in a really strong bid for a continued increase.
Level one! Whammy Bar have been waiting 13 weeks to open their doors again safely, and now they're back. This Thursday is Welcome Back Whammy, featuring the big shredding energy of Cindy, lo-fi doo-wop from Nah Noise, and the extraordinary DJ Matthew Crawley. Doors at 8, free entry. Then, this Friday, Eno and Dirty with an all-star Black Lives Matter fundraiser. And this Saturday, Klang's Samari album release party. Contact tracing is in place. If you're sick, stay at home. Kia kaha from the Whammy crew.
Thank you, New Zealand. We made it to alert level one. We united against COVID-19 and came through. And now it's time to unite for our recovery. We can all unite by buying local to help get our businesses and communities humming, by seeing New Zealand and experiencing our culture, and by buying Kiwi-made goods to help local producers thrive. We've shown that we've got this. Now let's show that we can recover too. Unite for the recovery.
Wednesdays, one to forward bridge. Tune in for your fair share of great open-minded tracks. A wide range of supportive and encouraging music with Bridge. Kick back and chill with the Wednesday one to four with Bridge.
The
same.
The Wire.
Like, naked is the theme. Like, people just love getting naked.
Yesterday evening, Police Commissioner Andrew Costa announced that New Zealand Police will not continue with the Armed Response Teams model. The trial, which started last year in counties Manukau, Waikato and Canterbury, ended in April and faced controversy since its very first day. Widespread political opposition came from the Green Party as well as the Māori Caucus of the Labour Party. A claim was even filed with the Waitangi Tribunal, arguing that this failed to inform Māori and demonstrated poor partnership and constituted a breach of titiriti or Waitangi. Andrew Costa delivered a one-minute statement about the dissolution of the Armed Response Team via social media last night.
Today I've announced that Armed Response Teams will not be a part of New Zealand's model of policing in the future. The basis for this decision is feedback we've received from the public, from engagement with community forums, and from the preliminary results of the trial evaluation. Everything New Zealand Police does is to keep the public safe and our people safe. It's become clear through the course of the trial that armed response teams do not align well with the style of policing that New Zealanders expect. As a result, we will not be continuing with them. We have listened to our people through the course of the trial, and what we have learned is there is opportunity to improve the tactical capability available to help deal with difficult situations. We are committed to exploring options short of routine arming that will improve our ability to keep the public and our people safe. As we develop that program of work, we will do so in consultation with communities to ensure that the style of policing we adopt is one to which the public buys in.
Now, it can't be overlooked that in recent days, protests around the country, sparked by the death of African-American George Floyd at the hands of a police officer, have shown loud and clear the public opinion in regard to armed police here in New Zealand. Jacinda spoke to Rachel and Tess on the BFM Breakfast Show this morning about the announcement in the context of the protests. She begins by talking about the need for police training as part of the solution.
We do, of course, need to make sure that we're doing as much as we can to train our police, support our police when they are in situations where guns may be being used by those that they've been called out to come and intervene, because we do not want a situation where we see more often arms being used, but often where we see the police having to respond to those call outs, those are the situations where they are. So we want to continue to see our police not routinely armed, and that's making sure that they are really trained and that they have access to alternatives and that we get guns out of circulation generally as well.
Of course, in the last fortnight, we've seen protests, huge protests across the world, particularly in America, sparked by the killing of George Floyd by a police officer over there. And that has sort of been reflected in some of the protests we've seen in New Zealand. Obviously, we have a very different police system here.
Yeah.
And it is a very different context. But people
yeah.
are questioning the issues of race and policing in New Zealand. Do you have concerns about racial prejudice or bias in the policing in Aotearoa?
Well, I would pull back a little bit and say, actually, across our criminal justice system as a whole, there is work to do. And I think you see that in some of the agenda that we've been working to roll out, and in some of even right down to recruitment within the police, where our view has been that we do need to see our own communities reflected in our police forces. And then with that brings a change in culture and a change in approach. So we have been recruiting more frontline police, but we have also been recruiting more diversity in our frontline police. We've also seen greater use of alternative forms of justice within our wider system. So things like the use of iwi and community panels have been significant, and I'd like to see greater use of them. So I'd say, you know, we are not perfect as a nation. We have work to do, but I would say it cuts across our entire justice system.
The announcement was met by a number of responses from political parties. Marama Davidson, Green Party co-leader, says it is something to celebrate, reinforcing the need for people to make their voices heard. In particular, she emphasises that people of colour do not feel protected with armed police on patrol, and that this was a result of the systemic problems that police still need to address. Police spokesperson for the National Party, Brett Hudson, also agreed with the Police Commissioner's decision. However, New Zealand Police Association President Chris Cahill was sad to see some of the positives of the armed response team go, asking those who argued passionately against the response teams to work equally as passionately with police to tackle the problem of illegal firearms in at-risk communities. This was Jacinda Ardern's reaction to the Commissioner's announcement.
Now, last time you were on the show, Prime Minister, you said that while police operations are a matter for the police, you did express that you don't support the routine arming of the police. So do you welcome the new Police Commissioner's decision to end these armed response trials?
I would just say it's a reflection that I think the Commissioner of Police has listened to communities, and he's made that clear. I mean, actually, the evaluation was meant to take through to the end of June, but he was of the view that he had heard enough to know that it just, in his own words, didn't align with the style of policing that New Zealanders expect. And so clearly you can hear from that he's listened.
And that was Prime Minister Jacinda Ardern speaking to Rachel Ashby on the 95 BFM Breakfast Show this morning. Now, lastly, I'd just like to highlight some problems with the trial itself, which may have contributed to this dissolution. The major problem was with officers not adequately recording call-out data. In the first 2 months, just 17% of forms were filled out, according to an EBPC document from January this year. While others were concerned with the overuse of the response team being called out 75 times a day on the first 5 weeks of the trial. Over the six-month period, they were called out over 50 times as frequently as the armed offenders squad is over a year. While it was noted that the team was meant to focus on high-risk and gun crimes, they were used most commonly for simple traffic stops. Firearm offences made up less than 3% of the incidents, with 500 of the people being apprehended not carrying a weapon and only 14% carrying a gun.
That was The Wire.
Kōrā te hōtaka katoa mō tēnei rā. That brings us to the end of our show for another week. Nei te mihi ki a koutou katoa I kōrero mai ki au mō tēnei rā. A big thanks to all those who spoke to us for the show today. We had Eugenie Sage. We also had Marcus Jones from Dear Science. We had some clips in there for the libraries. And we had, who did you speak to about
New Zealand
Earth? David Riddler. That's everything. All right, thank you also to Felix and Jemima for helping me through. It's been a lot of fun. And now, up next is Bridge with the 1 to 4. Kei te whakarongo koe ki te rinangi poho. You are listening to 95 BFM.
That was a 95 BFM podcast. Support 95 BFM with a B-card. Go to 95bfm.com/signup.